Okay, the Economic Development and Housing Budget Division Committee will come to order for January 19th, 2010. We are going to be hearing a list of bonding proposals, as you all know. There won't be any formal votes on anything, however, unless we have to change some language in some bills, because we'll be eventually be making a recommendation to the full bonding committee as to which ones we think should be pursued and funded. So give us your best shot. We have several authors on the agenda right now that are either in other rooms or in other hearings or are on their way. So as long as Senator Dill is here and his people are from pretty far away and they're ready to make their presentation, we'll start out with Senator Dill's bill. It's the Dassel-Cokato Ice Sports Arena. So, Senator Dill, whenever you're ready, you may begin.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This Senate file does not have a number yet, but it's been something that's been under consideration.
And Senator Dill, maybe I should explain that. Most of these, all of these bills that are have an XXX on the agenda, they will be introduced in the next couple weeks here. They just haven't been formally introduced, which is why they don't have a Senate file yet, but they've all been printed. It's just a matter of having been formally introduced yet. So thank you for reminding me. Okay, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, we have a handout here that we'd like to have passed
okay,
out.
Okay, go ahead. Cap.
So, Mr. Chairman, members, thank you for giving me a hearing on this bill. This project has been worked on for about 12 years. It started when one gentleman from Cokato donated $400,000 for a regional sports ice rink center for the Dassel-Cokato area. And since then, there's been a committee of business people that have banded together and have raised another chunk of money. So they've got a commitment for about half of what is required for this sports center. The total cost is about $2.5 million, and they're asking for, in this appropriation, for one half of that, $1.261 million. I have two members of the committee here to help testify and so you understand this project better. One is Mr. Steve Benda, who's a mechanical engineer. He's got about 26 patents to his credit, and he's going to be the lead guy on this presentation. Then I also have Clark Moe here, another community, a member of the community organization is promoting this.
Go ahead. What are you thinking?
So, and I also like to just remind everybody that the bonding committee did visit this site on we went out to West Central Minnesota. On the way back, we stopped at the Dassel-Cokato. Mr. Chairman, you were there during that presentation.
Right, I remember.
So Mr. Benda, Steve Benda, do you want to? You almost have to be down here where there's a mic, though.
Okay. All right, now, which one, is one going to be pointing and one going to be talking, or are you both going to be doing talking?
Kind of a, okay.
Because if whoever's going to be talking, you got to be by a microphone. Okay. So either sit down by Senator Dill, or yeah, and then start out by saying your name for the record and tell us who your co-presenter is also.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. My name is Stephen Benda, and I'm from Cokato. And Clark Moe is with me. We're both from the Cokato-Dassel area. And thank you very much for hearing our presentation.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. And friends and other senators, thank you. Our project has had a 12-year history. We have been on this mission for 12 years, and it started with really the encouragement of a local business leader who saw a need, who saw opportunities in the regional area of Dassel and Cokato to bring an area that the local regional folks can gather and participate in a wide range of sporting activities as well as community gathering, civic type activities. And so at that time, $400,000 was donated to the then starting Ice Arena Board with the promise that we would build a facility that would have some of this gentleman's wishes and dreams and visions. And so with that, we've been on this project since the $400,000 12 years ago and have now amassed over $1 million of contributions, of community support, regional area people coming together to say that this vision really does make sense. And with that, it has a very strong kind of economic addition or it's an economic engine to our regional area. We have, during those 12 years, selected a site that's very optimal and I'd call it perfect for the type of programming that we do, and that's with a lease agreement, an agreement with our local school districts, and it will be located near the school. We have met with our local government agencies, being the City of Dassel and City of Cokato, as well as our French Lake and other surrounding areas, to one, have agreements in place with them for programming, and the other is just to feel their energy and wishes for a program like this. We have, during those years, completed our preliminary designs, which have really started and moved from A to Z, and at this point we've reached an optimal design that fits the needs and the site location. And as stated earlier, we have half of our needed resources in the bank and committed. And the real beauty of this project is that we are shovel ready to begin in the spring of 2010. Our project status, we have a total need of $2.39 million, of which we have in-hand cash $743,000. We have commitments of land to the value of $200,000. We have in-kind commitments, which are the crafts, local interested people committing some of their talents and resources, $187,000. And so our funding request is $1.26 million. We have the preliminary surveys and designs complete for the local area, being bore samplings, surveys are complete. And of those are part of our in-kind contribution. We have the project broken in ways that we can we say shovel ready in the spring of 2010, because we have broken it apart into very achievable phases based on how we see the construction happening. And we have designed and built the facility around what we consider to be very sustainable, energy conscious considerations, and we'll outline those in a moment. One of our boards, Clark, right behind me, the regional, as you see right behind Senator Dill, is a representation of our regional area. It's in your handout, where the circles really are kind of a dot on the map that show the area of influence around the rink in that specific area, the civic centers in those areas. And you can see by the way that's mapped out, where the X is the green, right in the middle is an area that's an unfulfilled area where the kids in those areas are drifting to some of the other facilities and participating on those other rinks. And so as we laid out that map, you can see the regional area inside really is one of the baseline items that helps us or helped us find the location being where it is today. And you can see on your handout the regional areas. We've listed areas of Annandale, Maple Lake, Delano, Glencoe, Howard Lake, Waverly, Kimball, Kingston, French Lake, Winstead, Lester Prairie, Litchfield, and Silver Lake. That's a pretty large square mile area that this will help to program. We have the next area, which we think is very important to the regional impact, is that we have this set up in our phase construction method, where our local tradesmen, this is the immediate impact. As our local tradesmen, our regional businesses will be participating, the professional services, And it will absolutely energize our regional area for various collaborations. We see that happening already. The long-term effect we see on this is that there will obviously be employment. We have the local businesses, regional businesses impacted where there'll be new business generated. We'll bring in new customers from around the region because of various programmings that happen, tournaments, trade shows, boat shows, whatever we can program in the facility will draw external dollars. And it'll bring, as stated, new dollars into the region. Some of the regional programming that we see happening, as we found out earlier in our 12-year history, is we sent out surveys to the area through our local newspapers and received input back, and it looked for areas for community gathering, areas for local programming, being boys and girls hockey programs, figure skating and public skating, a golf program, a baseball program, a ski program, and really it becomes an all-purpose, all-season regional area for those type of gatherings. One of our original donors, the $400,000 contribution, came from a gentleman who was, he spent his life learning and participating in the etiquettes of golf, and one of his visions and wishes is that this facility not only house the winter sports of ice and skiing, but it would also have tee boxes set up in the facility where we spent long hours talking together about how we would return the golf balls back from the other end of the hockey rink when they're blasting or teeing off from above the concession stand. He was quite a man, and I was fortunate enough to have spent many months working with him.
That's only a 9-iron, you know.
That's I hear you loud and clear. But fear, you know, you can visualize that with some nice screens and return systems that the areas that or the local schools and community programs that wait for our Minnesota winters to subside would have some serious fun in there. We think that this is also a facility that we can build a very strong educational model around. What do you mean, a model educational around hockey or skating programs? Well, here's what it is. This facility, because of those of us around it, we visualize this to be kind of a technical center where we can put BTU management systems in place and energy conservation systems that will actually have the participation of the local high school kids in the local high schools in a way that these young men and women can actually be involved in control systems, being involved in interfaces with the utilities, looking at ways to squash down the electrical energy uses. And we truly believe that using some of the more modern innovations that are available to us now, that we can put some programming in place where these kids can learn at the same time that they're getting their physical education and regional gathering areas. We'll talk about that a little bit more in a minute. It'll also energize the local business leaders. We've seen this time and again in our many years of traveling to civic centers and hockey facilities. They have started where the community doesn't have a hotel, but a hockey rink comes into town. The next thing you see pop up is an American Inn. What happens is that these type of facilities foster other business leaders and entrepreneurs to put things in place that really I would call it is part of the economic engine that drives our local communities to prosper. We've seen that with several rinks that we've participated in the state of Minnesota.
Mr. Ben,
yes.
Senator Metzen and I have always said that hockey is all about education and economic development. We've always said.
Sure. My thumbs are up. Thank you very much. Thank you. The sustainability part of this is we believe that the design and operational considerations using a convert versus a consume methodology is the best practice today. I mean, you know, it's really a buzzy word right now to save energy and have the green machine and all of those things. But we see things where in the cross section of the rinks in Minnesota and even for that matter Wisconsin and Michigan, we don't see some of these very easy systems being used. For instance, power factor control. Probably a scary word to some, but it's a simple way to look at the incoming energies that come from the utility to ensure that we're not causing them to have undue losses on their system. Very simple to do. And environmental resource utilization, where I think of a facility in Upper Michigan where they actually have their air-to-air heat exchangers outside cooling down the glycol that cools the rink inside. What are they doing? They're taking the cold from outside and putting it into the indoor rink through systems of heat exchange. And to me, that's a good practice because we're not running our electric compressors and motors as much as they need to. We will when the compressors need to run, we'll take that waste energy, as you see in many facilities, the big plume of steam coming off the backside of a hockey rink. We'll take that waste heat and we'll pipe it under the bleachers. We'll put it into the concession areas. We'll put this into the areas where the people need to be, whereby minimizing our kilowatt hour usage. Simple. Use high efficiency lighting. We have been gathering used equipment throughout the state of Minnesota and picking up used and very viable components and materials for our project. Those will apply to us. We'll use that. We are actively engaged in agreements with the utility, our local utility being Wright Hennepin, to look at that agreements and very favorable mechanisms that we can use for minimizing our electric bill based on some of the other practices to minimize their peaks and valleys on their electric transmission distribution system. And coupling lastly some of the energy considerations that are available to us in Minnesota, where we'll have geothermal and solar considerations from our sun, how we locate our building and where and what facades have our windows, et cetera, will give us another chance for a high school child or student to monitor what's happening, pipe those that heat throughout the building so that we can minimize the energy usage. My personal goal is that this rink operate at a lower kilowatt usage than any other in the state of Minnesota. We can make that happen. And then the operational end of this, which we also want to have an interlacing interconnection with the high school kids, are our key component measurements, some of the parameters in the facility, movement of BTU, kilowatt usage, internet access to our electric kilowatt usage through the agreements we're working on with the utility, so that the kids can see that some of the decisions that they're making or that some of the decisions that the electrical control systems are making really make a lot of sense for reaching the goal that we have of being lowest kilowatt hour usage. And some of the techniques will be some advanced infrared technologies as well as some very, very simple data acquisition systems. Mr. Chairman, that is our brief statement, and I certainly would be open to questions if any of the senators or public would have any.
Very, very good. Mr. Moe, you got that's kind of a popular name around here, so I don't know. Do you have anything you want to add? You could sit down in that chair right there if you have anything you want to add, but otherwise if Mr. Benda has covered it all. That's fine.
Thank you.
Chairman.
Okay. I mean, you don't have to say anything.
I'll take questions if there's any questions. Okay. I think Steve covered it quite well.
Senator Metzen.
I think, thank you very much. I think you get an A-plus for your environmental initiatives on this structure. I really commend you on that. there was just one sheet of ice in this building?
Well, yes, sir. Yes.
Is that enough to take care of the advent of the girls and young women
for
the region?
Thank you for asking, because it is actually a second sheet of ice to our Litchfield Dassel Cocato school connection that we have. And it is right now along that lines. We have our JV kids, who are our least experienced drivers, traveling from the Dassel-Cocato area all the way over to Litchfield at 5:30 in the morning to practice. So this, the addition of this rink is a second to our association.
Mr. Chairman, that was part of the thrust when I carried the Mighty Ducks bill, is the girls playing, and oftentimes they were on the ice at 4:30 in the morning, which just wasn't fair and wasn't right. And how far is Litchfield from Dassel and Cocato? There, 7-8 miles or 10?
No, it's
12 to 17.
Yeah, it's from my home, which is north of Dassel, is 26. I'm north of Cocato. I'm 26.
Okay.
So we're probably city to city. I bet you we're 20.
Just one more thought. Your picture of the building you're going to build, from the outside, there's no frills or anything. I mean, it's pretty plain. Can you jazz it up a little bit with the money you're going to get?
Well,
I mean, it's just a big tin. Sometimes that, you know, appearance makes a little difference. But that's all you can do for $2.5 million?
Well,
it's kind of cold looking. Is it a steel building? But
well,
you got
It's kind of a rendering at that point.
All right, it's pretty early in there.
Yeah, it's, you know, we have the preliminary designs done, which are the infrastructure and the systems that are inside. But your comment on the facade is noted, very well noted.
Yeah, when Senator Dill gets this done, we want it to look pretty good for, you know, the area.
Thank you.
And if I remember correctly, when we were out there, you're in a pretty big space, so if you actually didn't need another rink, yeah, there's probably enough room to put it in, right?
There may be at that time, yes.
Okay. Senator Kielash.
Yes, I just my question is, you talked about the phases, and that you still have permitting. Can you give me a timeline for when the project is – you have it started, but I don't know if that means the – groundwork, or if it means that you're ready to do the all the mechanical stuff, or is this going to be a 1-year project and can be completed in 11 if we get
very
started?
Very good comment, Senator. In fact, Clark Moe with me leads up our committee on the construction and that, and I'd like him to speak to that.
I guess right now we've got a simple approach. It's a 3-phased approach. Phase one is to get the shell up. Phase two is skatable ice. And phase three is the mechanical refrigeration of bleacher systems concession area. We've got estimated that it's about a 1-year time frame if we had the funding to keep things going through seamlessly. And Steve had mentioned earlier, we have plans to get started in the spring with the phase one with the funding that we have on the table. So a 12-month if it was seamless with no funding hurdles.
Okay. Any other questions or comments? Senator Dillon, Senator Kubley?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Benda. You know, I guess, you know, you've got these circles that I assume show the service area of the other centers out there. Yet when you draw a circle around the Cocato area that goes out quite a bit further, it looks like your service area is about 3 times the size of the others. Is that an accurate portrayal, or... have these, all the communities you've listed, have they indicated support for the project? Or
actually, it's an interesting comment that you bring up, in that the when we would call our service area, we're in an area that there is lack of service right now. Just to kind of reshift that, in that the Dassel-Cocato, even down or up to the Knapp, up to the French Lake area, Kingston, is we all travel those miles to the Litchfield rink to participate in their programs, because we don't have refrigerated ice in our local area. And as far as some of the other programming that happens, right now our golf program reaches down into the Glencoe area, where it's bringing some of the young kids from that area up all the way up to Cocado to participate in our local rink area, our golf course, all the way over to Delano, bringing kids over for our ski program. And those both of those programs are currently sustained by volunteers and interest generated off of some donations, as well as annually we travel to Michigan to participate with the National Ski Patrol, and we bring back about $40,000 worth of donated equipment every year to match up with kids and families in our area so that they can participate. So it's sort of a long answer to that, but was what we saw when we put the areas of influence around the local rinks, you could tell why we're driving the amount of hours and miles that we do in order to participate in these type of activities.
Just one more comment. I was mentioning the majority leader that wasn't like about 12 years ago. There were 250 or so girls playing ringette hockey. Now that's approaching 4,000 girls that are skating and participating now. So
yes, indeed.
It's really, really caught on big.
Okay. Senator Dillon, any closing comments?
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, this organization has been working for 12 years to put this project together, and in 12 years they've raised the $1.2 million on a planning and studying on this issue, and I would respectfully request some favorable consideration from the committee and the full bonding committee as well in the final bond.
Okay. Thank you very much. And we'll lay this over for possible inclusion to a recommendation to the bonding committee. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, Senators, public, thank you.
Thank you. Very nice presentation. Senator Pogemiller.
I knew you were setting me up there.
Can we play games? How many cute pictures?
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you for allowing me to be here. I've got two projects. We'll try to keep them relatively brief. First one is Granary Road, which is a third priority of Minneapolis's this year. It is phase two. The deed has already put in money for phase one. With a local match, there's already been about $8 million expended on this. About half of that was the state's, as I understand it. So this is phase two. It's $5.3 million for pre-design. There'll be a local match of that same amount. This is a critical infrastructure article necessary to potentially create up to 6,200 jobs adjacent to the University of Minnesota campus. And I'm going to turn it over. This is an area that is old railroad yards and outdated industrial buildings that has no access to it. And Granary Road will create the kind of access that is for modern times, which will allow this creation of hopefully up to 6,200 jobs. Turn it over to Mr. Mike Christensen.
6,200.
This is you'll see quickly here. Okay. Mr. Christensen.
Mr. Christensen, please welcome to the committee and say your name for the record, please.
Mike Christensen. I'm the director of the Department of Community Planning and Economic Development of the City of Minneapolis. Thank you, Senator Pogemiller, Majority Leader, for your leadership in developing this part of our city. As you know, this is the area bounded by the university's fabulous new TCF football stadium, and as you know, Senator Pogemiller inserted in that legislation something called the City University Alliance, which really cares for the development future of the five neighborhoods surrounding the university campus. This is squarely in what is known as the Southeast Minneapolis Industrial Area Semi-University Research Park. It's between the football stadium and 280.
It's home now to 108 grain elevators, many railroad tracks, but it is quickly becoming an exciting transition area for the city of Minneapolis, its mayor and council. Introducing you today to the new head of the council's Intergovernmental Relations Committee, Elizabeth Glidden. Thank you, Councilmember Glidden, for joining us and supporting this high priority for Granary and the city's capital request. As Majority Leader stated, this group has expressed support in the past for Granary Road. Indeed, awarded through the legislature $3.5 million for the first phase. From a funding standpoint, your work is done on phase one. You'll see phase one if we can get it up. This is the area I described, bounded by red, 550 acres.
Maybe for those of us who don't know Minneapolis real well. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. Goes right here. 94 goes right here.
Okay.
See a closer map here, Senator Pogemiller. The new stadium, you'll see in a moment. That's, of course, University Avenue and the Central Corridor plant area. It follows University Avenue, then jogs over. You see the stadium right there.
And the red is the...
Well, that'd be great to put that Central Court...
thank you, Senator Pogemiller, but that might be another hearing. The TCF Stadium is bounded by this really exciting University Biomedical Discovery District. You've heard testimony from Frank Serra, the Vice President of the Academic Health Center, for 4 years now on this area, the development of this area, awarded $292 million in bonding authority. Two buildings into that amazing campus. The job number you heard from Senator Pogemiller is based on a ratio that Dr. Frank Serra has explained to this committee before, is pulled out of the model of the Madison University Research Park in Wisconsin, and based on a Battelle study issued in 2002 around that new medical district. There's a ratio of jobs in immunology, neurology, and Alzheimer's research, which you may have read about in today's paper, has already been seeded into that new building, the first of four out there. The next slide will show you the private sector research park and how the council's master plan sees the future of this area. At present, this is industrial, some housing along University Avenue, but it is clearly in transition. And the market prices for land reflect that. There's phase one of Granary. For your purposes, you're done with phase one of Granary. You've done your part. Thank you. Appreciate the legislative support for phase one, and that is underway. Phase two.
Mr. Christensen, that's the $3.5 million?
Correct.
From deed and state bonds and plus $500,000 matched by local funds? Okay.
Here. Then on phase two in yellow, you see where we're headed. Phase one went from Malcolm to 25th, and phase two goes from 25th to 17th through that old industrial area and just to the north of the TCF Stadium and behind the new biomedical building and, of course, the McGuire building, which has been over there for 4 years and has been busy producing jobs.
I think everybody's figured this out. Mariucci's right here. And Williams Green is right here.
Mariucci
Williams Alumni Center.
Stubborn herbs.
Yeah.
Now we know.
Yeah. Right.
I got a boot on my car at Stubborn Herbs.
There's one boot, though.
So the total cost, as Senator Pogemiller outlined, of phase two is $19 million. We expect the city to put up 2.5. In fact, we have put up 2.5 committed from TIF in a pooling arrangement, again, sponsored by Senator Pogemiller and approved by the legislature 3 years ago. And then we're seeking $7 million in federal safety lieu money. We've received a high score from the federal government on that, so we're confident that that's proceeding. The remaining gap is $4.2 million. We're seeking $5.3 million. To help close that gap.
With that money, we will do all but actually build the actual road. The actual road we would expect to need slightly more in a bonding request in 2012, probably about $4 million. There's phase three currently under study. We're just beginning local process around that. That goes along the railroad right-of-way all the way over close to 35W. Both Minneapolis and St. Paul need a bioscience connector in this area, both for bikes and cars and other vehicles, obviously truck and transit traffic to these future bioscience campuses will be crucial, and it will be hard to come by with Central Corridor placing University Avenue under construction. This is full development with the stormwater ponds that the city's providing, obviously for runoff, to reduce runoff in the area. And you see how important Granary Road becomes to the local roads that will be serving these bioscience campuses. Again, at present, we have market interest that's growing. There are people who now own property in the area that can build with these infrastructures support. So we are confident with this bonding request that you would see thousands of jobs created long term. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Just out of curiosity, Ms. Christian, does this development, if in fact you get 6,200 jobs, is there parking anticipated in this? And it seems to me there's a parking problem over there, so I don't know if there's room for 6,200 new cars, but
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There are parking problems all over the city, but I can assure you that with 550 acres, we can solve them. And right now, we have parking issues all around the downtown areas for the major campuses where we've come up with solutions like Alina's 2,400 employees at Midtown Exchange, Techne's 550 employees on Stinson Boulevard. It's usually a mix of structured parking and local parking of other types. We have not asked for any part of that in the bonding request, and we wouldn't anticipate asking the legislature to support that. We may have to do that through other means.
I guess I'm just curious to see if you're planning for it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes, we are.
Sure. Senator Dibble.
Also, Mr. Chair, thanks. I just point out that the LRT is close to there. And Mr. Christensen mentioned making this road also accessible for bikers, so people will get there in other ways than cars. Plus, there are some pretty big ramps that aren't too far away from there that aren't fully utilized at this point.
Senator Metzen.
Yeah, just out of curiosity, this was this property with its industrial background and with the railroads there. Has it been cleaned up, or have you received or requested petrol cleanup funds? Or maybe the property is better off than I think. I hope it is, but I can remember that railroads and all of that stuff years ago, and I guess it would be polluted. I'm not sure. Has that been fixed up, or have you tried for some of that money also?
Mr. Christensen.
Mr. Chair, members of the panel, we have successfully competed already for over $1 million. From Deed. Deed's been our partner throughout.
That's part of the 3-5. Is that correct? Okay, I didn't see that broken out, but I understand, though.
Thank you for pointing that out to the committee.
Okay. Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And just to respond to Senator Metzen, it's a good reason to make these renewable development funds competitive on a statewide basis rather than, you know, so that
sure.
They can be used in the metro area in addition to greater Minnesota. Yeah.
You explained it to us.
It's in a conversation we've had in previous legislatures.
Senator Kulesh.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Christensen, did you say there's already private development being or people building in the private development private sector in the research park already as a result of the buildings that are already up? Or is that in the planning stage?
Mr. Chair, Senator Kulesh, the latter. In the planning stage, that you will notice that several lots out there have been flattened. That's not an accident.
Yeah. Okay.
Any further questions or comments? Senator Pogemiller, any closing comments?
No, Mr. Chairman. Again, we've We've appreciated the partnership with the state on this and the potential for this. It's at one of the major intersections of the state, 280 and 94. It's just the right place for this kind of development.
Okay, we'll lay this.
And this is simply the public sector piece to what's going to be very strong development.
That's where it should be.
There's match funds. Looks like there's match funds coming. That's public match funds, but then you're talking about a whole bunch of private investments. Okay, all right. So okay, so we'll lay this Senate file XXX over for possible inclusion in a recommendation to the bonding committee. Thank you very much. Are these guys up also for the next one?
Nope, next one is.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The next one is the Walker Sculpture Garden. This is a joint project of Minneapolis and the Park Board. The Walker Sculpture Garden is where the cherry on the spoon is that you're all familiar with. It was basically built by the Walker with a land donation by the Park Board. So it's pretty much a privately invested structure. It's been there, not structure, but facility. It's been there about 20 years. Because of its location, it needs, because of pollution, road salt, and everything else, it needs significant work to maintain it as a major attraction for the state. Over 7 million people have visited it. About 400,000 people a year. So it's a major destination for people from all over the world in terms of our community. The upgrades can create up to 170 jobs. And this is for phase one, which is an $8.5 million pre-design. And I want to turn it over to the top person at the Walker, Olga Viso, to explain to you the vital need for this.
Welcome, Ms. Viso. Please say your name for the record.
Hi, Olga Viso, Director of the Walker Arts Center. And I'm actually joined here also by Commissioner Tabb. And I also wanted to say some remarks before I get into the details of the bond request. So thank you.
Commissioner.
My name is Anita Tabb, newly elected commissioner to the Minneapolis Park and Recreation Board. And I'll just take...
And what's your maiden name?
Anita Tabb.
And your maiden name?
Pinto.
Okay, all right, okay.
The Italian, that's right.
Do you know Thomas on it?
I do.
Oh, I'm trying to find every Italian in this state, isn't it?
I just want to thank you so much for the opportunity to be heard today on this really very major project for the Minneapolis Park Board. And I do want to emphasize that it's been just a really wonderful partnership between the Walker and the Minneapolis Park Board, that it really is a unique partnership to which we have been looked at throughout the nation. So it's been very successful in that way. I also want to emphasize that it's been a wonderful resource, not only for Minneapolis citizens, not only for citizens in our region, but really I think it's also a very lovely state resource that I think makes many, many of us proud. So, Olga, thank you so much.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you, and thank you for the opportunity to come here today. When the Sculpture Garden opened almost 22 years ago, it was recognized as being the first and really the largest urban sculpture park in the country. And so it's free every day of the year. It's really served the state exceptionally well. As you heard, we welcomed over 7.2 million visitors since the Sculpture Garden opened in 1988. It attracts more visitors than two-thirds of our regional parks and reserves and trails, which I think, again, underscores its statewide importance. And nationally, I think it's also important to acknowledge that the Sculpture Garden is recognized as a model of civic collaboration between an entity like the Park Board and an institution like the Walker Arts Center. It's brought a lot of attention to the state, and we continue to be visited by delegations from around the country, from different states and cities that are looking to do urban development projects, cultural facilities, et cetera. Just in the past 5 years, cities like Dallas, Chicago, Seattle, Kansas City have all built large urban sculpture parks costing between $50 and $100 million each to realize and to build what we already have here in the state of Minnesota and can retain with an investment of $8.5 million, which is the bond request that we have for you. And as you heard, this will create immediately 170 jobs, landscape and construction jobs. It is a shovel-ready project, and we can complete most of the work by the end of 2010. So the garden, I think, has really proven to be a valuable asset to the state from an economic, educational, tourism, and community standpoint. And it brings together, I think, two things that really make this such an exceptional state to live and work and be in. And as a fairly new resident, having an incredible outdoor space and really internationally renowned culture come together. A number of free programs are offered throughout the year, many for families, including the Walker's very popular First Free Saturdays family programs that offer on-hand activities for children. I think it's also important to note that of the 7.2 million visitors since 1988, 45% of them are national and international tourists, that is, coming from outside the 11-county metro area. And in terms of the direct economic impact, a recent Meet Minneapolis analysis estimates that the direct impact of spending related to the sculpture garden is approximately $16 million a year, and that's a conservative estimate that doesn't reflect the multiplier effect of dollars entering our state's economy. I think it's also important to note that more than a quarter, that is 26% of the 350 to 400,000 people that visit a year, are young people. Many visit with their families or come with school groups, and there are more than 120 registered school groups that come each year, and 25% of those school groups are from around Minnesota or outside the Twin Cities area. So, and there are likely hundreds more. If any day, given day, when you walk by the Sculpture Garden, there are numbers of buses that are pulling up for tours, many that are registered, but others that come on. So with this incredible popularity and also, say, significant use and heavy use of the garden over the last 21 years, it's really taken a toll, which has resulted in significant deterioration to the infrastructure. Infrastructure that was state-of-the-art when it was built but has now really worn due to heavy use. And so the bonding request before you will resolve these infrastructure issues. The capital investment that would made into the infrastructure would also bring environmental sustainability, energy efficiency, green design, and also bring significant reductions in operating costs. And some of the key components in that bonding request include a new irrigation system that will reduce water usage by 50% and by reusing storm runoff from the parking lot that is just adjacent to the garden. Significant changes to the stairways and ramps systems will also make the facility compliant with current Americans with Disabilities Act requirements. A new mechanical plant, piping, and floors for the Coles Conservatory. And this accounts for about 30% of the garden's annual maintenance costs. Will be reduced and really make that a much more energy efficient structure. Enhanced drainage system will compensate from the ground compaction from the heavy use and the popularity of the garden. And this will also allow us to replace the concrete, install structural supports for the granite walls, and we will reuse the granite at renovation project. Also, trees and plants that have frankly reached the end of their life, through the arborvitae that are really only last about 20 to 25 years. They are really approaching their end, and this will allow us to replace those. Also replace light fixtures and infrastructure elements that are going to increase public safety as well as improve accessibility. So those are some of the highlights. You have a packet of slides before you which show you some slides and images of some of those specific renovation aspects of the proposal. But we really urge you to support this bonding request. It will allow us to renovate and preserve a very dynamic symbol in our state, allow us to really continue to serve not only Minnesotans, but the considerable tourist populations that come to the Sculpture Garden each year. It will really allow us to preserve it for another generation.
Thank you. Any questions or comments? Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to express my support for this request. I think it's a modest request for what will result in some jobs that will get going yet this year, which is, I think, important for us to pay attention to. And if folks have been to the Sculpture Garden lately, though it's a wonderful and beautiful and a really nice place to go and obviously attracts a lot of people, it really is worn out. It's used heavily. It has a high water table. You can see the pictures in the slides, the heaving of the granite blocks and the grass that's worn out and the pathways that are worn out and the arborvitae that's dying off. It's just starting what is a kind of a jewel and a real attraction is starting to turn around and become pretty unattractive. And so this is an important facility for us to really renovate and revitalize.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Pogrom,
just wanted to point out that this is an extremely modest investment in one of the major cultural institutions in our state, which is by and large totally handled privately by the Walker. When they did their expansion, it didn't help. That was done by the Walker itself. And maybe Ms. Vizo could tell us what has been the private investment in the Walker and its campus in the last few years. And secondly, how much is the art in the garden worth?
Thank you. Every year we contribute about $300,000 a year to do the free programming that's offered year-round. That's on the average. The initial investment that the Walker made into the construction and the development of the Sculpture Garden was $16 million back in the 80s. And the value of the artwork is now estimated to be $55 million. And our own staff cares and preserves and takes care of those sculptures year to year.
And the investment in the Walker expansion was how much? That was totally done by the Walker.
It was $100 million.
$100 million in the last couple of years, the expansion of the Walker. So this is for $8 million, we are kind of protecting that kind of investment that has taken place privately.
Senator Metzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The expansion money was just the $100 million.
And that none of that was public money?
None of it. That's what my question, and all philanthropic and private donations.
Their endowment and...
Really? And so this is the state put over all those years?
Excuse me?
The state has put almost nothing in. The park board donated the original land for the Sculpture Garden. I don't know if they donated the original Walker land or not. This is a privately endowed philanthropy operation, and the Walker is internationally, the Walker Art Center is a big deal internationally.
So you've had, Mr. Chairman, over 7.2 million visitors, and half were from outside of the metro area. And the value that's been put in so far is a couple hundred million, and you're asking for eight.
Correct. That's the sum. To show you how internationally significant the Walker is to our community and to the United States, it competes with the Louvre on various things and has actually beaten the Louvre on some international awards. So this is a
big deal.
This is a big deal, the Walker, to us.
Now, has the Guthrie moved away, right? Has that changed the traffic patterns at all? Have you seen anything different happen as a result of it, or?
Our attendance has remained very, very strong. In fact, I think it's important to point out that the Walker is, in the top five museums of modern contemporary art visited in the country. So together with the Museum of Modern Art, the Guggenheim, San Francisco Museum of Modern Art. So, and again, 40% is out of state, so visitation. So that has remained consistent with the programming that we do. And the Sculpture Garden is a big part of
it makes a cutting edge in terms of its appeal to the cultural fabric of the nation.
Does anybody ever fall off that spoon?
We're not supposed to be on it. Yeah. We're not supposed to be on it.
There are video cameras there to deter it.
Mr. Chairman, I've seen a photo recently where that spoon was, that cherry was on the top of your head. Where did I see that?
The cherry. I got it on my cell phone.
Oh, you showed it to me.
In fact, Senator Higgins took it. Where is she?
The tour. And was that just happened, or would he pose for that?
I'm not sure if she did it on purpose or if I did it on purpose.
Well, you look great with a cherry on your head, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Well, thank you very much. You've been very generous with your time.
Any comments or questions from the committee before they leave? Okay. Thank you, Senator Pogemiller. We'll
leave
this
over.
Thank you
so much.
Thank you. What do we got here next? Senator Higgins. As long as we brought your name up, we might as well bring you up to the table.
Lynch has been here, too.
Yeah, I know. I told her she was going to be first.
Oh, you want to wait for Lynch? You're up at 4:15.
That's part of being a freshman.
Twin Turkeys right here.
Excuse me.
Okay. All right.
Bill, does she? No. Okay. Senator Higgins, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr.
Chair. Target Center improvements.
The city of Minneapolis purchased the Target Center in 1995. Currently owns and maintains the facility. The state receives sales and income tax proceeds from the facility. Target Center was financed with city-backed bonds, and the debt service is met by a variety of city sources. The state did provide $750,000 each year for 15 years, but the last payment was last year in 2009. Target Center is home to the Lynx and the Timberwolves, as well as the state high school basketball tournament and many, many concerts and shows. To keep Target Center a viable facility, the city has committed funding for capital improvements. A new roof was completed in 2009, and arena improvements, mostly in the interior of the bowl, were made over the past few years. The request before you today is to assist in the asset preservation and improvements. In particular, some safety and security items, surveillance cameras, and more. I have with me here today Steve here, who's the executive director of Target Center, and Steve Mattson, the general manager. Mr. Ethier will go first.
Thank you, Senator
Welcome
Higgins.
To the committee.
Appreciate your leadership. Chair, members, I'm Steve Ethier, Executive Director of the Minneapolis Convention Center, and oversee the city's contract with AEG for the management of the Target Center. Apologize for the technical problem. As Senator Higgins mentioned, the city of Minneapolis owns the Target Center. The city assumed that ownership in 1995 in order to retain the major tenant, the Minnesota Timberwolves, within Minneapolis. The city has made a considerable investment since assuming that responsibility for this tremendous asset, including the debt service, capital investment, and subsidizing operating losses since the early 2000s. That capital investment, as Senator Higgins mentioned, $14 million over the past 6 years. The city's current financial plans include $5 million per year capital investment for the next 10 years. I believe it reads $5 million over the 10 years. It should be $5 million annually for a total of $50 million for the next 10 years.
That's the city's investment.
That's correct, yes.
Okay. And then
I remember a real controversial bill back when I was in the House. Is the state giving $700,000 a year? Is that still going on? Is that
Mr. Chair? No? They had been, but that ended in 2008.
Okay. All right.
As Senator Higgins mentioned, besides being the home of Minnesota Timberwolves and the Lynx, the venue hosts many national touring concerts, professional sports contests, family shows, such as what's currently running Sesame Street Live, that attract thousands of tourists from not only greater Minnesota, but our surrounding region and Canada. In fact, a single mixed martial arts event in 2008, sold-out event at Target Center attracted 25% of its attendance in Canada. Additionally, Target Center is the home of the Minnesota Boys and Girls High School basketball tournaments, as well as, in 2010, the Boys High School hockey sectionals, high school dance competition, and other events involving young people from around the state. The direct economic impact to the state is significant in the way of sales tax and payroll withholding tax.
I know those Canadians really like to spend their money when they come here. I know that.
Yes, okay. They do.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Glad to have them as neighbors. State withholding payroll tax figure of $7.6 million is an annual figure. Sales tax state portion in 2008 is $3 million, and that has been trending on the rise in the last few years for a total of $48 million since the inception of Target Center. Yes, sure.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks. And to be clear, those are sales taxes that are directly attributable to activity at the facility itself, not spillover in the downtown area of shopping and dining and the like.
Dibble, that is correct. Those are directly attributable to what's generated within Target Center as a direct sales tax to the state of Minnesota.
Thank you.
In addition to the indirect economic impact, as Target Center contributes, as alluded to by Senator Dibble, state revenue, state sales tax revenue through lodging, restaurants, clubs, retail in Minneapolis, as the events do draw significantly from our greater region and Canada. For further economic impact, the various entities within Target Center employs 200 full-time people and 700 part-time jobs. And those part-time jobs, as we know, are so critical in today's economy. They employ everyone from college students to our seniors within our community to supplement their income. Target Center further contributes to the workforce within the hospitality industry, as well as all the services provided on a daily basis that keeps Target Center operating, including supplies, office equipment, AV companies, to electrical, plumbing, HVAC, food and beverage, and cleaning services, just to name a few. Our proposed project for state bonding will be extremely labor-intensive and dedicating to the overall guest experience, improving accessibility, privacy, and public health, and meeting today's current requirements for ADA standards. This building was constructed, designed in the 80s and constructed in 1990, and we would be improving those core elements of the facility that most people experience. And our proposed project will be extremely labor intensive and positively impact the industry in Minnesota that's in most need through this economic downturn: construction. We would employ carpenters, plumbers, concrete masons, electricians, general laborers, and others that have suffered through this economy. There have been 20 new arenas built within the NBA alone in the last 15 years. Our objective is to reuse Target Center while using recycled materials for this project, installing water-saving fixtures in the restrooms and energy-efficient lamps in the restrooms and concourses in order to make this facility a much more sustainable venue under the largest of its kind, Green Roof. This chart illustrates the very significant direct economic impact of Target Center to the state in terms of sales tax. And as I alluded to earlier, it's been trending upwards since 2006, which incidentally is when the city contracted with ADG, who is the current operator of the building, to manage the facility. And again, this is really a summary of our request that we urge you to support. Again, the proposed upgrades will significantly enhance the overall experience, make this venue a more competitive venue, more appealing and more attractive to all people within the state of Minnesota and our surrounding region. The proposed projects are core elements and long-term viability of this great asset to the state of Minnesota. Thank you for your time, Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you, Mr. Mattson. Are you the technical guy here, or do you have anything to add?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. Vice President, General Manager for Target Center, for operator AEG for the City of Minneapolis. I'll just echo Steve's comments there that, you know, I think the Minneapolis-funded Green Roof that opened in 2009 kind of tipped off the theme here of sustainability and taking care of this asset. We sit as one of the five oldest of 29 NBA arenas, and our intent is to continue to take care of this building. And the infrastructure needs are many for those who have been here, been to the arena recently for games, concerts, family shows. But this, along with additional city funding, private funding from the manager and the team, will go a long ways.
You know, we always hear a real lot about the revenue generated by the private boxes. This was back in the days when we can get into the private boxes, but I always thought you had really neat private boxes. I don't know why, but I thought that the way they did those there, they're very interesting. Are they a big generator of revenue for you, or?
Mr. Chair, they are. I think Target Center is fortunate when it opened in 1990 that its boxes exist in the location that most boxes still do today, and that part of it has been fairly timeless. The sale of those is dependent upon all the products in the building. If the team is down or the non-game events are down, you know, the sellability of those suites can be down. And we can say right now that the team may be down and the other events have been strong to offset that, but they're a vital revenue stream to the overall building. I think the style of suites that they are out there is has evolved, but ours are still very popular as they are. What we are, though, is part of a district that has an enormous number of suites, especially with the advent of Target Field, TCF, and I think that part of the evolution of the building will be to adapt, is the current number of suites, and is it the right number for a market that's evolving with a variety of venues?
Now, is this $6.5 million, is this the whole project, or is that what the state share, and then Target Center or Minneapolis or the owner of the basketball team or somebody else putting in more money to do more renovations, or is this the whole project?
Mr. Chair, we have a city-approved 20-year capital plan that we will start funding in 2011, $5 million per year for the next 10 years for all projects to modernize the building, and as Steve mentioned, to bring Target Center to today's standards, not necessarily state of the art, but certainly a modern facility of which we can all be proud of.
Yeah, that was the $50 million you referenced earlier.
And AEG is also committed contractually to a $2 million capital infusion.
Okay. Any
Senator Dibble.
Thanks. Mr. Chair, I also wanted to speak up in support of this request, not surprisingly.
How much you for today? How much of this? We got to start adding
I got,
up the total.
I got more coming down the pike. It's all good. It's all jobs, Mr. Chair.
I agree.
And these are good jobs. But if you look at the chart, you know, where there's a little drop-off, the sales tax, you know, that's when the facility was falling into a little bit of disrepair, and it was reflected in how well it was performing, and of course wasn't producing as much sales tax. And we got a new outfit on board now, is running the some capital investments were made. They talk about the green roof. It's and anyone who's been to the Target Center can tell it's a lot better than it was a few years ago, and it's obviously being used a lot more. It's a lot more competitive. So long as the public is going to be owning professional sports facilities, an idea of which I'm not super crazy, but as long as they are, they should run them as well and as best they can, and this will help go a long ways to accomplishing that. So okay. That we have sufficient returns, so that it's reflected in the sales tax, et cetera.
Well, you know, that's a pretty interesting chart about the sales tax there, because it does give a pretty good indication of the economic impact that some of these places have on communities and on states. And so I'm glad you brought that forward to show exactly what's going on here. Anybody else have anything else to say? Okay. Senator Higgins, would you like to make any closing comments, or has everything been said?
Better. Okay. Yeah, it's giving. Mr. Chair, I know you have a lot of bills to hear today, so I won't make a long speech, but I think you can see the benefit to our community and the state in having a good, viable Target Center. And I know that with Lindsay Whaling coming to the links, we're going to have even more people coming
home.
That is kind of fun, isn't it? Yeah, she's coming to Senator
Metzen.
Senator Metzen.
Chairman, the Timberwolves won a game.
Yeah.
And they did? Oh.
Came from behind last night, 20 points down.
In overtime.
I don't care how they won it.
It's all 2 points. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We'll lay this over for possible inclusion and recommendation of the bonding committee. Senator Pretner Solon. Welcome to the committee,
Mr. Chair.
Western Lake Superior Sanitary Sewer District.
Yes.
Is that correct? Is it sanitary?
Western Lake Superior Sanitary District, okay. WLSSD.
All right.
That's right.
Is Superior in there, or is it just Western Lake Sanitary Sewer District?
Western Lake Superior Sanitary District.
Ah, the sewer's not in there. Okay. All right. Okay.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you for hearing the Senate file, which as yet has no number, which is a request from the Western Lake Superior Sanitary District for state bonds to construct sanitary sewer overflow facilities to prevent wastewater from flowing into the St. Louis Bay and Lake Superior. I have with me a witness from the Western Lake Superior Sanitary District, along with representatives from two of the district's largest customers, the New Page Paper Company and Sappy Paper Company, who will explain how important it is that we secure funding for this project in 2010. Both the City of Duluth and the Western Lake Superior Sanitary District are under a mandate to eliminate wastewater overflows into Lake Superior. The City and the Sanitary District have signed a consent decree with U.S. EPA and the MPCA, which stipulates a very strict timeline for stopping overflows into the lake. Failure on the part of the City and Sanitary District to construct the facilities necessary to prevent overflows will result in a very large daily fines and the imposition of restrictions on development within our city and within the jurisdiction of the WLSSD. WLSSD and the City of Duluth each have a request for bond proceeds to build the last two sanitary sewer overflow projects required to come into compliance with the consent decree. But it is the sanitary district that is under the tightest timeline to come into compliance. The The consent decree provides that the Polk Street facility for which funds are being sought in this bill must be constructed by November 20th of 2011. In order to make that deadline, this project needs to be funded this legislative session. At this point, Mr. Chair, I will turn it over to Mary Ann Boren, the Executive Director of the Western Lake Superior Sanitary District, who can provide more details regarding the project and the circumstances that the Sanitary District faces.
Welcome, Ms. Boren.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee members. My name is Mary Ann Boren, and I'm the Executive Director with the Western Lake Superior Sanitary District. I'd like to call attention to two pieces of material that are in your packet. The first is a summary of our bonding request. It looks like this. And the second is a very thick, ominous-looking document, which is the consent decree. And you should have a copy of both. We were fortunate enough last year to also be able to address the committee with this request. Unfortunately, funding, the state funding resources were not such that we were able to acquire any funding towards this project, and thus we really didn't start this particular project. We are under a very unique circumstance. There are a lot of bonding requests before the state. There are a lot of requests to the Public Facilities Authority in regard to controlling sewage overflows. However, we have the distinction, the Western Lake Superior Sanitary District and the City of Duluth, to be under federal mandate under a consent decree to eliminate these sanitary sewer overflows. The large document you have in front of you basically dictates that those points within the Western Lake Superior Sanitary District system and the City of Duluth system that have had past overflows need to have those overflows eliminated by 2016. The consent decree also dictates specific deadlines for each of those overflow locations. Page 21 of the consent decree notes point number 7, and point number 7 is the Polk Street overflow location, and that's the point that corresponds to our bonding request. This particular location has overflowed over a number of years occasionally, and it really, at times, overflows have occurred in the middle of the Irving Field ball field. It's a small community field where kids play softball, and when overflows occur, it tends to happen in the middle of their ball field. There's also a bypass into Keene Creek, which is a small creek that discharges into the St. Louis Bay, which then discharges into the St. Louis River, where when this particular pumping station is over capacity because of excess rain, untreated sewage is released. Because this is such a long-standing problem, when the consent decree was negotiated, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency specifically wanted this location addressed first. And so the consent decree, while we negotiate back and forth on deadlines, both the federal government and the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency dictated that overflows from this location had to be eliminated no later than 2011. And we know how to do that. I used to work for a research facility where the head of that research facility used to say, you can have it cheap, you can have it right, you can have it fast. Pick two. And unfortunately, with the deadline of 2011, we need to do this project right, but we also need to do it quickly, which means there's no longer any time to look at source elimination. There's been a lot of dollars already spent in source elimination, but at this point, the only thing that can be done to fully eliminate overflows from this particular location is building a new pumping station and building a 1 million gallon storage facility to store sewage for further treatment at the Western Lake Superior Sanitary District. When we build that, this point will no longer overflow. This is a final solution for this particular point. Unfortunately, it's $6 million. And for the Western Lake Superior Sanitary District, we serve approximately 17 municipal customers and 5 major industries. And expenditures that we make, both capital expenditures and operating expenses, are covered by those 22 customers. In a perfect world, we would complete this project, but we would likely delay it for 2 or 3 years because of the state of the economy. No, it is no different in northeastern Minnesota than it is statewide. Our industrial customers are under pressure, our municipal customers are under pressure, and people don't have $6 million to pony up for this project. The consent decree, however, if you look at page 46 in the document, dictates what happens if we miss these compliance deadlines. Fines begin to be assessed on a daily basis. And for those penalties, if we would delay this project a year, we would be paying the federal government and $1.6 million. And those fines would continue to accumulate on a daily basis. So not complying is not an option. So for $6 million, we are on the Public Facilities Authority PPL list for 2010. We have 81 points. We are well positioned for a PFA loan. However, the Western Lakes Pier Sanitary District also has capital needs for the next 10-year period of $11 million. That's about double what the annual capital needs were for the previous 10-year period. We are no different than any other utility. Our lines are getting old, our pump stations are getting old, and our customers are perfectly willing and able to meet what our capital needs are. However, when we have things like the consent decree, where we've got a $6 million project over and on top of what our capital needs would be, it's difficult to ask for additional money. The one-page handout that you have in front of you, at the very bottom, if you look at the left-hand corner, kind of dictates which customers would pay which portion of that $6 million should we not receive any bonding assistance. And you can see for the City of Duluth, this particular project will cost them $2.8 million. But for the City of Cloquet, it's $250,000. But probably of even more concern in our region is our two major industries we have the paper industry. We have Sappi and we have NewPage. And for Sappi, this project is going to cost them $2.6 million. And for NewPage, it's going to cost them $1 million. And because of that concern, we've got both mills here also with. So I'm going to turn it over to Paul Heller for NewPage to also give a few words on why this is so important to our local industries as well.
Well, thank you, Mary Ann. Mr. Chair, members, good afternoon. My name is Paul Heller. I work for NewPage Corporation. I'm also a member of the WLSSD board. NewPage Corporation is the largest producer of printing and writing papers in North America. It's headquartered in Miamisburg, Ohio, and has 10 mills located in Minnesota, Michigan, Wisconsin, Kentucky, Maryland, Maine, Scotia. Duluth, our mill employs 300 people in full-time jobs, high-paying manufacturing jobs, and we make C paper, super calendar paper. The best way for me to describe that is when you open your Sunday paper and you see the Target ad, that's our paper. So we supply not only Target but other retailers as well as magazines, catalogs, and direct mail. So basically NewPage's business is advertising driven. With the recession, ad pages have fell 30% year over year. Catalogs are down 25%. Our market, depending on grade, shrank between 20 and 35% in the last year. We have taken significant downtime, market-related downtime in 2009. Demand for us hit bottom in the second quarter of last year and has continued in a trough up until this fall when things picked up historically, driven by stronger sales during the holiday season because of advertising. The forecast for 2010 is for continued weakness. Demand is expected to stay down by 10 to 15%. Pricing levels have fallen and are expected to recover in 2011. So our customers are delaying advertising. People start spending money, and we're all basically waiting for employment to increase. With respect to this project, NewPage believes that Duluth is a good place to do business and prides itself in being a good corporate citizen. We're in full compliance with our pretreatment agreement, the I&I ordinance that's in place. And as a good corporate citizen, we recognize that the I&I problem needs to be fixed. And we're willing to help solve this municipality-based problem. Yeah. Unfortunately, this project cannot wait. The economy economy recovers and the paper industry gets healthy. And to do that, we need your help. So as a WLSSD board member and an employee of NewPage, I'd ask you consideration for this funding of this $2.75 million project. Now I'll turn it over to Guy.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Guy Unertle. I'm an employee of Sappi Fine Paper in Cloquet, Minnesota. Sappi has approximately 750 employees directly employed in the Cloquet area, depend on the wastewater treatment facility at WLSSD, and there are numerous other support employees who rely on the Cloquet mill to make a living, including starting in the logging community. Sappi Fine Paper is a global company that makes decisions on where to produce paper based on economic viability of its plants. Sappi has facilities in North America, Europe, Africa, and Asia. Within the past several years, Sappi has shut down the paper mill in Muskegon, Michigan, announced plans to shut down the Kangas, Finland paper mill, and within the next month, we'll be shutting down the pulp mill in Lesotho, South Africa. Employees at each of these locations want to continue to work, but economic considerations make it impossible for Sappi to continue operation in these locations. Sappi Cloquet has a capital program that strives to make improvements in productivity and quality to keep the Cloquet facility viable, along with improving safety to our employees and meeting environmental commitments for residents of Northeast Minnesota. Marianne's comment earlier about source elimination, Sappi and Cloquet has already spent approximately $17 million on capital to reduce I&I inflow and infiltration, source elimination from rainwater at the Cloquet facility as part of our commitment to reduce water sent to WLSSD. At this point, now we're, rather than being able to spend money on keeping the Sappi plant economically viable for the future, we are being required as part of our commitment to WLSSD to spend money on this basin approximately 20 miles away from the Cloquet facility. We appreciate your support for this project and keeping the Cloquet mill viable. And I'll pass back to Marianne.
Again, we appreciate your consideration. We take any questions people have. I think what we really need to communicate is we will be building this project in 2010. We don't have a choice. It would make it far easier for us to do that with some state help, and we certainly appreciate your consideration.
Ms. Bourne, just out of curiosity, you have a couple of pretty big figures here that it says WLSSD has spent $20 million on overflow elimination since 2002 and more than $30 million in overflow-related capital costs from now until 2016. Was none of that considered in the consent decree? The consent decree seems to be pretty rigorous to me.
Yes, the consent decree is very rigorous. If you compared a map of 5 years ago with overflow locations to overflow locations noted in the consent decree, what you'd see is there are roughly half the number now in the consent decree as there were, 5 to 7 years ago. And that's primarily because both the Western Lakes Superior Sanitary District and our customers and the City of Duluth have spent a lot of money eliminating overflows. However, we're not perfect. And that's what the consent decree is really dictating, are those remaining points. And it's really mandating perfection. No more overflows. They have to be eliminated, and they have to be eliminated immediately. The $30 million, in the next 10 years, we'll be spending $100 million in capital at the Western Lake Superior Sanitary District. Approximately $30 million of that $100 million is related to ensuring that either points that are in the consent decree are eliminated, or points where there are vulnerabilities, lines that need to be either replaced or relined, are addressed. We are fully committed to making sure that what is required under the consent decree is satisfied. However, we're also very cognizant of the fact that the economic viability of our area also is dependent on affordable wastewater treatment, and that gets really tough with the requirements we're being asked to meet right now.
And just out of curiosity, Mr. Heller and Mr. Arendall, do these
figures that are listed here, if you end up having to pay that much, do they have a kind of impact would they have on your business?
Well, you know, for us, I guess the best way to answer that is NewPage is probably, it's in the worst market conditions we've seen, or I've seen in my career, and it's very difficult to determine which way the market's going to go and when it's going to get better. It's put a lot of stress on our business, and our employees are constantly looking for ways to, you know, save money and keep the business sustainable and viable. You know, like Guy has said, when you're in business, all the mills are competing to be sustainable, and everything that we can do to make ours sustainable is going to be very important to keeping those jobs in the South. So I guess I would say that. The other thing I would say is, you know, as a board member, it's been very gratifying to work and be part of the sanitary district. I think Mary Ann and her group have done a good job, particularly in this year, to keep costs in line. They've gone out and found ways to really keep our costs that we pay, in good control, and we're hoping that that continues. And we're also hoping or asking for your help to with this particular project.
I think one thing I think is very important for the committee to understand is the cost of the Western Lakes Superior Sanitary District are shared amongst all of the customers based on their percent of loading compared to the total. But roughly, the industry component of the sanitary district covers half the bill. So should these major industries disappear, the costs already invested in the sanitary district need to be spread. And so we would be looking at municipal wastewater treatment costs doubling should one of these businesses or multiple businesses go away. So it's very, very important that we're doing what we can to make sure that both our municipal customers are healthy and our industrial customers have wastewater treatment that they can afford.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure if I understood exactly. Is it Boren?
Boren, yeah.
Boren. Exactly what you were saying. So maybe you could clarify it for me a little bit. I was interested in what you said about doing things either quickly or right or low, being efficient. And I'm sure that you are bound by what's it in the consent decree, and there may not be any latitude there. But how much of what you're talking about spending, if any of it, is being caused by that need to go quickly, or are these things that are good to do or ultimately are going to have to be done anyway? Because I can imagine that we don't want overflowing untreated sewage under
absolutely.
Any circumstances.
Absolutely. The $30 million that we referenced that we'll be spending from now over the next 10 years, in that $30 million, we have no plans at present for any additional sewer overflows. They are all INI inflow and infiltration elimination type projects. There are pipe replacements, pipes that may be old and leaking. There are lining of pipes. We've spent a fair amount of time with our customers through an INI ordinance, making sure that all of our municipal customers and our industrial customers have INI reduction plans in place. Guy Nerdle made reference to the fact that SAPI's already spent $17 million, and that was really related to eliminating part of their old pulp mill, which had roof drains that were connected into the system. So the municipal customers particularly have spent a lot of money resolving the problem. When we talk about issues like the Polk Street Basin, if you look at the one-page handout in the middle, there's a chart of what the flow looks like in that pump station. And what happens in that particular basin is during any given day, like today, the difference between what the average flow is on any given day and the flow when we have a lot of rain, and I'm talking 2 to 3 inches an hour rain, a very heavy rain event, the flow into that pump station will increase by 17 times. That's not because there's new discharges into that pipe. That's because there are connections. There are probably roof drains someplace that shouldn't be connected. There may be leaking lines somewhere. There's been a lot of money spent in that basin doing smoke testing, addressing roof drain disconnections, addressing lining of pipe. But even with all of that time and money, this still happens when it rains. And what the consent decree is saying is, you know what? Time's up. That location needs to be eliminated by 2011. The only way to do that is to build a sewer overflow basin to hold any of that excess flow that comes into the system during the times of heavy rain, so it can be pumped to the sanitary treatment system in Duluth and treated. So that's part of what we get with the consent decree. The consent decree puts deadlines that basically eliminate any time to look at maybe things that may be a little bit longer term for correcting the problem. This will correct the problem. It's expensive, but it's fast. But it has to be fast because the federal government and the PCA are saying time's up. It's got to be fixed, or you can start paying us a significant penalty each and every day until you do correct it.
Senator
Olson. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that helps me understand it a little better. But and then my next question is maybe for the gentlemen who are with you. I'm wondering whether the businesses that you represent are going to be viable in the longer term, assuming that things are starting to turn around with the economy in terms of protecting those jobs. And I say that having been through some discussion several years ago with the logging industry and what happened there, and we made some concessions and we lost the jobs anyway. So I guess I'm just wondering, we want to help you keep those jobs in place, and how are things looking?
Any guesses?
Well, I guess to be selfish, I still have a long time to work before I can retire, and I'm working every day to keep that facility viable. I'd like the question was asked before, what does this mean as far as if we aren't able to do this work and we get penalized, what that would mean. And for rough numbers in Cloquet, that would be the equivalent of each employee at Cloquet costing $1,000 a year in penalties to continue operation, and that's not viable. But I feel strongly we've made some very good moves in the Cloquet facility to keep going forward, and SAPI is committed to keeping that operation going. But the danger is we work in a global economy. But that's where we have to work smarter and harder.
Well, we do our best down here to keep you
thank
keep
you
working.
So.
Okay, any further comments? Senator Kielash.
Yes, I'm just curious as to if there's any federal funding or outside funding that's been requested or in the pipeline to help with this project or these projects, I guess, as you move forward.
And we have, we did also last year have federal requests in. Looking for a Corps of Engineering funding to help with this particular project. It was not forthcoming. And for 2010, the Section 569 Corps of Engineering funding for the region, for this particular region, was total $900,000. So they were only able to fund three very small projects, and this was not one of them.
And how about stimulus money?
Stimulus right now, there are, of course, all of the speculations whether the federal government will approve any additional stimulus money. When we came to you last year, I think one of the things the state was looking at is at that time, no one knew how much stimulus money was coming in and how it would be distributed. This project was not on the 2009 list. It was on the 2010 list. I think really PFA is the only one that can probably address whether there's any additional stimulus money remaining.
Yeah. Okay. Senator Solon, any closing comments?
Well, Mr. Chair, remember that this all results originally from the, I think, 1971 Clean Water Act, which the federal government mandated and has only recently begun to provide some funds for the cities and districts to comply with. So something we've been looking at for a long time and working on for a long time. And when I was on the city council in the mid-'80s, we were working on solutions to this. But we have come down to the line now where we have to do something. And it isn't that we haven't been doing things all along. It's just such a costly, costly thing. And remember, we're at the bottom of the hill, so we're probably getting Chisholm's rainwater as it comes down.
No, I think ours goes down the Mississippi, but but I was going to say that. Glue's on a hill, and it goes into Lake Superior, and that's a big part of the problem.
So. Right. And, and Mr. Chair, if we don't meet these deadlines, it means that development is going to stop in our district. And we can't afford that to happen for our economy.
Okay. Thank you very much, and we'll lay this over for possible inclusion and recommendation to the bonding committee. I think we got you, Senator Lynch, now. Are you here? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, so members.
We have a number on this one, Senate File 381. Is that right or no?
That's correct.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We are here today to talk about jobs. And we have before us a request for $34 million. I am pleased to report to the committee that the state, through the bonding bill, has previously appropriated $3.5 million to this project. So in light of that, the design on this project is completed, and this project is truly ready to go. You know, as the bonding committee traveled across the state viewing the various proposals in a number of communities, it seemed to me that there were two pieces of criteria that sort of elevated to the top, particularly this session and on this tour. And that was projects that were well-suited to create jobs. Sometimes those are construction jobs. Sometimes those are jobs that are ultimately offshoots of construction that is completed. And the second criteria, I think, that was noted or could be noted is that there are a small number of projects in the bonding bill or in the bonding cycle this time that have the capacity to bring new revenue into the state. And so I am pleased to be here today with the Mayo Civic Center project, which I would suggest to you fits the criteria on both of those notes. And I think to begin with, I'd like to ask Wes Ervig to elaborate a little bit further about what these jobs entail and what this has the capacity to mean for southern Minnesota and for Minnesota.
I'd be happy to. Senator Lynch, Mr. Chair, I am president of the Southeastern Building Trades. I represent 2,600 union construction workers in southeastern Minnesota. And I can tell you that right now, the unemployment rate...
I know we know your name, but just say your name for the record.
Excuse me. Wesley Ervig.
Okay,
thank you, Mr. Chair. Our unemployment rate is running at 40% right now. And I almost hate to say unemployment percentages because it doesn't really represent the men and women that are so highly skilled that are sitting at home right now. That represents 1,000 construction workers in southeastern Minnesota that do not have a job right now presently. This Mayo Civic Center expansion will put to work over a two-year period over 400 of those construction workers. It's one of these jobs that will probably end up to be 55 to 60% labor. It represents over a million man hours of work. The bigger picture is this could create a lot more work in the Rochester area. Will there be a need for another parking ramp? Most likely. Will there be a need for more restaurants and hotels? More than likely there will. So Mr. Chair, I'm here to talk about these jobs and the great need for them in southeastern Minnesota on behalf of the men and women of the southeastern building and construction trades. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Jones.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Brad Jones, I'm the Executive Director of the Rochester Convention and Visitors Bureau. I represent the hospitality industry here today, which is the second largest employer in the city of Rochester. We are about 12,000 employees and counting, so a great deal of workforce, and I should say also that we support the number one employer being the health sciences in Rochester. So specifically about the Mayo Civic Center, the current facility, and some of you I know have been there, Rochester currently does not have a convention center. If you look at the Mayo Civic Center, it is a multi-purpose center that has been built and added to several times, but we've never had a convention center. So when we have a convention, we typically mask arenas and multi-purpose space with carpeting, temporary carpeting, pipe and draping to make it look like a convention center. We currently don't have proper audiovisual technology. It's an antiquated facility. This expansion would address those two things, and we're very well situated for a particular market segment in the biosciences, health sciences, and technology to take advantage of that now. Not later. We've primed the pump, if you will. We have the red carpet ready. We just need this facility to get done. We currently, just so you understand, with the current facility, we say no to a lot of business. We say no, and that translates to lost business. Over the past few years, we've turned down about 68 events that would represent $74 million in spending. And the reason that we say no to those events is because we don't currently have space, or we don't have the right type of space that they're looking for. We've targeted 50 health science-related organizations, a vibrant industry right now, and they're seeking out places to meet, and we're well-situated to take advantage of this. They want to be in Rochester. They want to be next to the Mayo Clinic. They want to tour their facilities. They want to hear from their professionals, their physicians, clinicians, researchers, nurses, all of these types of folks. And this expanded facility would give us that opportunity. We're talking about jobs today, and this we've expanded after construction period that this would support, would create and support about 800 full-time jobs within our industry. That would represent additional frontline service providers, good deal of management support folks, new businesses, new business creation in our city, which, like I said, we're well primed to see happen. This would increase our economic activity in Rochester from about $113 million to $157 million, so an increase of about $44 million annually with this facility. And that represents additional delegates, meetings, conventions, and events to the tune of about $118 a day per delegate when we look at those new events. So, and I would like also to point out that these folks that we're going after don't currently come to Minnesota. These folks go to Houston, they go to Cleveland, they go to Boston, they go to San Diego. They go to our competition, where the other major health players in the world are. So they're primed and ready to come to Minnesota, to Rochester specifically, southeastern Minnesota. And I'd be glad to answer any specific questions that you have. I know you have a handout that goes over a lot of these facts, figures, and information. Appreciate your time and attention, and would be glad to answer any questions for you.
You know, Senator Lynch and I sat through a committee hearing where somebody was contending that these construction jobs were not really good jobs because they actually came to an end. And, you know, maybe Mr. Irving, you should tell us how important these jobs really are to people who work in these in these industries, because it seems to me this is the industry that actually built America, built the roads, built the infrastructure and everything. And maybe you could comment on the importance of these construction jobs.
Mr. Chair, you're absolutely right. These are tremendously important jobs, not only because they provide health benefits and pensions and good pay, because this is the construction industry that built America. You're absolutely right. These are the local unions that have state-approved apprenticeship programs that train their men and women without any federal dollars, without any state dollars. They do it all on their own contributions between them and their contractor. And this is tremendously important. We have to remember that construction workers are seasonal employees. Many times in a given year, they'll get only 8 or 9 months of work in. Most of these 1,000 workers that are off right now, probably about half of them have been off for over 1 year. So they're very close to running out of unemployment if they have not. They're very close, and many of them have lost their health care or are trying to self-pay, which is very difficult to do on unemployment if unemployment runs out. But the positive thing is that if we can get these people back to work, many of the 400 construction workers that will be going back to work over a 2-year period will be coming right off of the state unemployment lines. That is a huge dollar amount savings to the state. So, Mr. Chairman, thank you for letting me speak on this. We are in dire need of jobs in southeastern Minnesota, and we would appreciate any help we can get.
Well, and one of the things, and I'm glad you emphasized it here, that sometimes we forget to say about construction jobs, is that when the job is over, you know, in this particular case, you're talking creating 800 permanent jobs for another 800 people who don't have jobs right now or who might be looking for new jobs. So, I mean, this bonding bill, it should be way bigger than what the governor's recommending right now, as far as I'm concerned. But this is a pretty good indication of the economic impact as well as the social impact that it will have on our state as well as the local area. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I wasn't there to hear that comment you're referencing, but it's really hard for me to even imagine someone obviously doesn't understand the construction industry if they think that those jobs aren't viable because they end. I mean, that's what construction does if it's successful. It builds something for someone else to be able to use, and then it benefits the economy in an ongoing way. But another point that I wanted to make and then to ask a follow-up question to that point. My husband is a salesman, and he talks to me a lot about the value of brands. And it seems to me that the Mayo Clinic is one of Minnesota's most valuable brands. It has international significance in terms of what it means to the prestige that it has within the medical community. And so to not capitalize on that brand as a state in bringing people here and making those opportunities available seems to me to be, you know, for operating our state like a business in terms of making wise business decisions, it seems to me it would be foolish to ignore the value of that brand if you want to look at it that way.
Senator, Chairman, that's a great point. Whenever we approach a convention opportunity, we always do a good job of going over to Mayo Clinic and finding somebody who is a part of that association. Many times they're on the board of directors or even an officer in that association, and they go with us. And I can't tell you how many times the door is shut on you when you're alone, but when you take somebody with Mayo Clinic, the door is always open. So that's a great example of the brand and the doors that organization opens on a worldwide level. This is an opportunity that if we didn't have that asset in our state, we wouldn't be having this discussion right now. It makes us very well positioned, and they are at the table making these sorts of decisions. They currently can't host the meetings that we're talking about. We just simply don't have the facility. We don't have the capacity. We don't have the type of space. They would be embarrassed to host those types of events. So great point, and we're currently working a lot of those angles, but we always do it with Mayo Clinic, not without them.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So then my follow-up question to that is, given the state of the economy right now, and, you know, there are always questions in the community about how successful convention centers are going to be and how much they're going to cost, and we just went through this in Bemidji, where I'm from. But since the kinds of things you would be hosting there most of the time would be related to the medical community and technology evolving around that, I'm just wondering if you've seen any, what impact the economy has had on, I mean, I'm sure things are going to come back and everything, but are you still seeing the pressure for bookings right now in this field or in this area, or is that down with the, with everything else?
Yeah.
In the economy being down?
A great question. And nationally, bookings into convention centers are down about 12% across the board. Attendance, more importantly, attendance at events are down about 21% across the board. Now I'm going to speak from a medical perspective. Medical meetings are down about 2.5% nationally. And most of that is representative of the corporate side of medicine, pharmaceutical, that type of thing. So that particular segment is down, but the medical associations are still very vibrant and meeting, and their attendance is actually up as opposed to the other associations. So very, very good. I don't have statistics specifically on the technology sector yet. We're waiting on those through the American Society of Association Executives, and they'll be out soon, and we can get those to you. But I would hazard a guess similar to the medical side of things. R&D is very robust, and development in microchips and brain power is still, those types of things are still meeting. So I hope that addresses some of it. This isn't really a bell curve. It's still, we see a 10 to 12 year window here of it increasing drastically.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Olson.
I'm really happy to hear that. That's kind of what I thought, just from, you know, just seeing how the stock market is performing and which sectors are doing better than others. But I think that just underscores all the more reason why this would be a good thing for the whole state to be funding.
Is there any way you can throw the weather in here? Because I've been noticing that it's been warmer in northern Minnesota. Yeah. Maybe there's something around here you can throw in. I don't know. Senator Kielash.
Mr. Chair, Senator Lynch, this has been on the books or in planning for a while now, correct me. How far along is it in the planning process? How quickly can the construction start? How close to shovel ready, I guess, is the real question.
Senator Lynch.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kielash, great question, and one that I have been pushing early and often in the community as we were preparing to bring this forward. And I can honestly tell you this project is designed. It is ready. It is virtually ready to go out to bid. And once the funds would be appropriated, we simply just need to process the paperwork with deed, and we're ready to go.
Thank you.
All right. Okay. Any closing comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the most exciting things about working on this project for me in my community was over time we have garnered the support of certainly the hospitality industry and the City of Rochester and the Rochester Area Chamber of Commerce and the Mayo Clinic and my labor leaders. And it's not often that all of those entities come together under one umbrella. And that's been, I'm very proud of all of them. And it's taken us some work to get there. But for our community, it's been a really good thing. And I wanted to comment a little bit about these real jobs that are being created. And when the governor's bonding bill came out, I had phone calls, I had emails, I had people stop me at breakfast or on the street. And they said, and they were my labor leaders and my unemployed construction workers. And they said, Senator Lynch, the Mayo Civic Center is not in the governor's bonding bill. What are we going to do? And for them, it wasn't about, you know, the fact that
Brad Jones is going to be able to, you know, fill this place with these medical conventions that want to come to town. It was the fact that they want to be able to pay their mortgage and put food on the table for their families. So I share your concerns, Mr. Chair, with regard to the size and the content of the bonding bill, and I hope that the committee will give this favorable consideration.
Okay, thank you very much, and we'll lay this over for possible inclusion for the recommendation to the bonding committee. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Senator Erickson Rope, Senate File 1409. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. We've invited Senator Lynch to the table with us as well. We are sitting in between or sitting on either side of Joel Young, who's with this Chatfield City. And
as you know, how lucky he is to be sitting there.
I feel very lucky.
We try to remind him of that. But we are actually lucky. Senator Lynch and I are lucky to share the small town of Chatfield. So they have two senators and two House members that represent Chatfield, and I think there's one home, actually, that's split in half, and Senator Lynch has the front half, and I have the back half. And I don't know how they vote, but it's...
Where do they sleep?
It's an interesting little town, a great community. We have a wonderful project that we'd like to talk about briefly to this committee, and I appreciate you putting us on your agenda at the last minute. This is the Potter Center for the Arts. It's a continuation of a program that was, or a project that was proposed a couple of years ago for the Bonding Committee that had to do with a much smaller project, and it's been expanded. And I think one of the greatest features of this project is the fact that it's a partnership between the city, the school district, private investors, business community, and the region. So it's a great partnership model, I think, that really is the direction that the state is going with investments. So at this point, I will let Senator Lynch say a few words if she wants, or otherwise Mr. Young is going to walk us through the project. If you have any questions, this, again, is a shovel-ready project, and we're putting a lot of focus on jobs. There's a big jobs bill we're looking at here, and we're hoping to bring 140 additional jobs to the Chatfield area. It's not as big as Senator Lynch's other project in Rochester, but it's equally as important for the Chatfield region. So we'll have us.
How about if we have Senator Lynch wrap up and we have Mr. Young?
There we go.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the opportunity to present to it. We believe it's a very important project to southeastern Minnesota. My name is Joel Young, and I'm the city clerk in Chatfield. The Potter Center for the Arts is a $9.5 million project, of which $2.5 million has already been committed locally. This will result in the recreation of a performing arts and community gathering venue that has served all of southeastern Minnesota for more than 75 years already. This project intends to convert a multi-purpose gymnasium auditorium built in 1935 to a state-of-the-art performing arts venue, and to convert the attached school building, constructed in 1916, into a modern community center, event support space, and office space for arts-related organizations. These buildings have become available because 2 years ago, the citizens of the Chatfield School District had the courage to commit $19 million toward the construction of a new elementary school facility, and to further commit another $3.5 million towards local improvements to support that facility. Because no state equalization aid was available for that school building, the taxpayers of the Chatfield School District are fully committed in paying for the basic educational needs of the district, hence our appearance before you today. The Potter Center for the Arts is a tourism and an economic development project. A recent analysis, which you should have before you, suggested it would result in $7 million additional tourism spending in the area. In addition to the 140-plus jobs that will be created by the project, it's anticipated that the center would provide the spark to spur private sector investment in our Main Street and throughout the region. This project is also a heritage preservation and a quality of life effort. Both structures that we're dealing with have been recently found eligible to be listed on the National Register of Historic Places, and that actual listing is being prepared as we speak today. In addition, 2010 will mark the sixth decade of community theater in the auditorium portion of this building. The Chatfield Brass Band, the Marine Corps Band, the Air Force Academy Choir, and school bands and choirs from La Crescent to Austin, and from Cannon Falls to the Iowa border have all made their music here. Southeastern Minnesota has long been a hotbed and has a storied history as a tourism destination and a performing arts destination. Community bands, choirs, and theater groups dot the area and regularly draw audiences from Rochester, the Twin Cities, La Crosse, and even Milwaukee and Chicago. This project seeks to capitalize on that history and foundation, and with more than 700 seats available, it's a fitting venue for these groups to display their talent. Finally, Mr. Chairman, the Potter Center for the Arts is a community project in every sense of the word. The Chatfield School District has provided the land and buildings to make this center possible. The City of Chatfield has provided the historic research and funded the permitting processes required for projects involved with listing on the National Register. In addition, the city has agreed to assume the responsibility of construction and operation of the center. More than 100 community volunteers and more than 20 organizations have been involved in creating the vision for this project. The studies before you, the drawings, the presentations, and the documents have all been donated by local or regional firms or funded by private in citizens. We've got the vision, we've got the commitment, we've got an excellent project. We just need some funding. We ask for your support to create this Potter Center for the Arts so that the entire southeastern Minnesota region can grow jobs and continue to benefit by the arts in the community.
Thank you. If I remember correctly, you got a pretty good bakery there, too, because
excellent.
I remember there were some pretty good rolls up on stage when we were there.
Yeah, we did very well. Thank you.
That was when I was on my diet, though. I don't know if I had one or not. I can't remember now. Are there any questions or comments from the committee?
Mr. Chair?
Erickson-Ropes.
I do have an A1 amendment that you'll be happy to see numbers being reduced on.
Yes. That would just mean less construction jobs. No. The project stays the same size, though. You're asking for less.
Yes.
All right. Senator Erickson-Ropes moves the A1 amendment. Does everybody have it? Does anybody have it?
No.
Okay. Well, we had one before. It just changes the $9.1 million to $4.754 million. So. Any discussion, questions? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion is adopted. Senator Lynch, would you like to make any final comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, this is one of those opportunities that you have to work together with a number of entities in a community to bring a project together to fruition. When I think about how I became initially involved in this conversation, it was anything but a coordinated effort. And so, again, I'm so proud of the community of Chatfield and all of the entities involved because they really pulled together so that we could advance this for the good of all. And the arts community in southern Minnesota is very much alive and thriving, and I see this project as tying in very nicely to the assets that we already have. So thank you for your every consideration.
Whose district is the building in?
That would be mine.
That was in your district. Okay.
Mr. Chair, Senator.
I wasn't sure if the line went right through the building. Or
it's all relative. It's all relative.
Senator,
Mr. Chair, I think that Olmsted County and what's one just south?
Fillmore.
Fillmore County.
Fillmore, I go right through the Millich House.
It does.
It is. Is there anything to this Chosen Valley thing about this?
It's a beautiful little valley.
The history of the Chosen Valley name goes back to the 1940s, and we've used that quite a bit. We appreciate the the identification that Chatfield, the, way, the name Chatfield gives to us, but the Chosen Valley is what that whole long area as you drop down coming from Rochester into Vilmar County is referred to.
So do either of your senators ever use the advertising phrase, the chosen ones, or? You guys don't have to answer. Okay. Any further questions or comments? Okay. Seeing none, thank you. We'll lay this over for possible inclusion and recommendation to the bonding committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members.
Okay, that ends the committee. No, just kidding. Senator Sharon. Thank you for waiting patiently.
Good afternoon, Chairman Tomassoni and members of the committee.
You might want to move left or right. Okay.
We will once we get up and running
right,
here.
Okay. Right.
Not quite a sensitive.
Welcome to the committees.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be with you. Happy that many of you are back to hear about this project, which is the Gaylord Aquatic Center. I heard you earlier, Senator Tomassoni, ask about the maiden name of one of the presenters because of the Italian mm-hmm. history. So I have with me today Kevin McCann, who's the Gaylord City Administrator, mm-hmm. But he is sometimes known as Kevin Macaroni. We have Chuck Klemek, who's the president
not
of
sure
the Gaylord.
I'm not sure that's valid.
is this being taped? Is the Gaylord Economic Development Authority. He's often known as Clemarino, Chuck Clemarino, and Dale Johnson, who is the Park Board of Director and Aquatic Center Chair, and his name is often referred to as Dale Johnassoni.
Well,
if that helps you understand.
You can't get any better than that. You sure you guys want to keep going?
Thank you. Anyway, I know the committee's been here long. We really are trying to keep our presentation within the 5 minutes that we were requested.
You've got 35 if you want.
35 minutes?
Yeah, okay.
And 35 for the Mankato project, too?
No, for two bills. For two bills, you got it.
Two bills.
We're
okay.
Here till four, so.
Well, I appreciate you, that.
You take as much time as you want here.
I'll begin with the presentation of Chuck Klemek, who is the president of the Gaylord Economic Development Authority. He will introduce the next presenters, if that's okay with you, Chairman mm-hmm. Tomassoni, and then I'll make some concluding remarks.
Mr. Klemek, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair. On behalf of the City of Gaylord, thank you for this opportunity to make this presentation today. Gaylord is at the heart of Sibley County.
Mr. Klemek, just say your name for the record.
I'm sorry. My name is Chuck Klemek, president of the Gaylord Economic Development Authority. As I said, Gaylord is located at the heart of Sibley County. With a population of about 2,300 people, it is the largest community in Sibley County. Sibley County has been designated as a economically distressed county by the U.S. Department of Commerce, and that was a designation for the current economic recession. But Gaylord, and I should say that that's the only county in Region 9 that has that designation. Gaylord, along with other communities in the county, have been working hard with several initiatives to improve the economic situation and hopefully someday rid ourselves of that designation. Some of those efforts have been cooperative countywide, for example, the Prairie Line Railroad or the countywide trail system. On the other hand, some of the initiatives are just within the city. Two of the major ones are we're hoping to create Gaylord as a regional senior housing center. We initiated that program this year with the construction of a continuum of care housing, senior housing complex on the shores of Lake Titlow, and we want to follow up in the near future, hopefully, with a senior wellness center as part of that complex. The other area,
Mr.
and the reason we're...
Mr. Clark, just,
sir.
Is, is the Prairie Line Railroad the one that goes 9 miles an hour? Is that the one?
Seven. That's it. That's seven. Faster than it's actually going.
It's a nine is too fast? Okay.
Run faster.
I was just checking to see if I remembered that correctly. Okay, go ahead.
The other initiative, and the reason we're here today, is we are creating a regional recreation center. The Gaylord Area Regional Aquatic Center is one element of a regional recreation destination location on the south shore of Lake Titlow. Arguably, this area is the nicest summer recreation area in Sibley County. Gaylord has already completed a number of projects and improvements to advance this recreation center in the effort to attract regional amateur sports tournaments and competitions. Over the last 2 years, we made improvements to Walsh Field, which is our baseball complex, to the point where we were able to host the state amateur baseball tournament for the first time ever in August of 2009. This coming year, we will host the regional Legion baseball tournament as well. We've expanded our softball complex to 3 regulation size fields, which now allows us to have larger regional and high school league tournaments. And finally, we have initiated a long-term project to improve the water quality of Lake Titlow to eventually make this a water sport destination. The Aquatic Center was selected as the next project in our program as a result of some community visioning and planning that was done along with the help of the Minnesota design team back in September of 2008. We asked the design team to look into multiple areas of the community, including downtown revitalization, housing, community center, and our recreation facilities. The Aquatic Center was the number one priority of the citizens that participated in that weekend. I'd like to say that we had 10% of the community-wide population. If you include the greater Gaylord area, we're probably looking at a population of 3,500. We had in the order of 350 participate during that weekend to help us plan a vision for the city. Now, future projects for the recreational center will include historic preservation of our band shell and our roller rink, both original buildings to the park, and there's some other smaller structures. We want to connect to the countywide trail system. As a matter of fact, the first phase of the countywide trail system will have have the head point in the city of Gaylord connecting to our trail system. And then finally, someday we hope to have a winter recreation complex, including ice rink, a sledding hill, and a warming house. With that, I'd like to turn over the next portion of my presentation to Mr. Dale Johnson, who is the chair of our Citizens Task Force looking into the Aquatic Center.
Mr. Johnson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, sir. I'm going to talk a little bit about our current facility. The current facility serves an approximately 20-mile radius. We serve the communities of Arlington, Belle Plaine, Gibbon, Green Isle, Henderson, Le Sueur, New Auburn, Nicollet, and Winthrop. They're just a few of the communities that we serve. We have a reputation for providing the best swimming lessons in the region. We give nearly 700 lessons a year. About 200 of the lessons are given to Gaylord children and residents, and the remaining 700 lessons are given to children from the surrounding area. Lessons are given to both young and old. There are 8 levels in the lesson program. Lap swimming and exercise classes are popular with adults. The Girl Scout competitive swim team uses our facility as a practice facility. The current facility is the only outdoor aquatic center in Sibley County. This last year, our facility had over 12,000 visitors. It is the most popular summer recreational facility in the region. It is the place to be in the summer. I'd next like to talk a little bit about our current facility conditions. The existing facility is 45 years old and is rapidly coming to the end of its life. During an inspection from the Minnesota State Health Department in 2009, it was determined that our 1- and 3-meter diving boards no longer met any of the safety requirements and as a result were taken out of service. the diving boards had been our most popular attraction. The maintenance and repair costs have risen dramatically over the past several years. Old equipment and corroded pipes are a major concern and have resulted in delayed openings in the spring and closures during the busy summer season. The facility does not meet any ADA requirements. It was designed for a staff of 60, and now we have approximately 36 people using, 36 staff members using that facility. Our bathhouse does not provide for any privacy at all. Current facility lacks amenities. The diving boards are gone, and the slide is for only the youngest users. The public needs a facility that has the features and play structures that will entertain, train, and provide a safe place to spend a summer day. The new aquatic center will accommodate competition, swimming, and diving events. At this point, I'd like to turn it over to Kevin McCann, our city administrator.
Mr. McCann.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kevin McCann. I'm the city administrator for Gaylord. Heard a little about the economic impact of the facility, the city, the area, the current conditions of our existing facility. So now it's time to talk a little about the proposed Gaylord Area Regional Aquatic Center. This proposed facility will be a state-of-the-art facility that will accommodate many features, including swimming competitions. The cost of this project will be $2.5 million. There's already a local commitment of $1.5 million towards this project. The project will be shovel ready by August 2010, coincide with the end of the swimming season. This project will create or retain 120 construction jobs from local and regional contractors. The completed aquatic center will employ 40 summer youth, and so with that, the request is for $1.2 million from the state in order to make the Gaylord Area Regional Aquatic Center as part of the development of our regional recreation center reality. So on the very last slide is the proposed facility. That, yes, I'll turn it back over to the chair.
Thank you. Is this going to be... Are you going to tear down the old facility? Is that what you're going to do? Or are you going to use that for something else? Or is it in the same place? What's the proximity?
It will go in the exact same spot, and that's why the construction would occur at the end of the 2010 swimming season, so that we could open in 2011.
Okay, so you won't be renovating the old one, or will you be renovating? No. Okay, you're taking it down completely. Okay, so you're ready to go then. Huh? Okay. Any comments or questions from the committee? Senator Sharon, would you like to make any final comments?
I would like to highlight some points because I know there are many requests coming from the committee about this nature, that this is a community that is in the heart of a very agricultural, very, very small community. This is the only outdoor facility of its kind in a very large geographic area. It serves more than the typical municipal concept of a swimming pool. It is a regional facility. It serves many, many people. And at the same time, you understand that that's in the context of a very small community of 2,300 people who already have a median income level 10% below other homes in the state, and also the property tax values against their homes is 32% below the median for home values. So to ask a municipality to carry this by themselves in this economy is very difficult. It has a capacity to create a destination, a recreational facility that in their vision will create not only this facility for the residents of the 20-mile radius that is around in all those communities, but they'll begin to draw competition for swimming into their area and build other kinds of economies around them. In a similar way that the sports facilities have talked about using as a way of creating an economy in their community. So Gaylord has, and the city county have been visioning to change this data that's in front of you. They have marked their median incomes and their household values as dots on a screen to be changed, to be moved, so that they can improve those numbers for their community. They need the state to help partner, because right now the environment for a community like this is such that it would be very difficult to carry them for their entire region by themselves.
So do we have any Olympic swimmers from Gaylord?
Not yet, sir.
But we do have a competition swimmer who we're roping in to be involved and ensure that that's future competition in the area meets the needs of competitors.
Good. Okay. Any comments or questions, committee members? Senator Dibble? No? Okay.
Sounds like a good project.
Normally when you do that, you have something to say. All right. Then we'll lay this over for possible consideration and the recommendation of the bonding committee. Thank you very much. I appreciate your presentation. You have one more, Senator Sharon.
Senator Tomasoni, next presentation is from the City of Mankato, Southern Minnesota Women's Hockey Exposition Center and Minnesota State University Mankato Performing Arts Center. I have with me Jeff Hedges, who you've all met on other occasions. We've been in front of this committee several times and in front of the bonding committee on this project. Pat is the Mankato City Administrator. With him is Jonathan Zert, who is our director of the Greater Mankato Area Growth in Mankato. Shannon Robinson, who is the executive director of the Twin Rivers Center for the Arts. And Rick Strucka, who is from Minnesota State University and is the university's vice president of finance.
Did this one get vetoed?
Yes.
Has this been vetoed? Is that your question?
Yes.
Twice, yeah. I've had that experience, so I was just making sure, because it looked pretty familiar to me. Anyway.
Yes. You've been generous to come and visit it on several occasions. Mm-hmm. But with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Hedges.
Mr. Hedges.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Pat Hedges, Mankato City Manager. Our project is essentially a multi-purpose project. We have an event center. It's approximately $50 million project under today's dollars. It's a multi-use event center, one of the first in the state. In addition to that, this project involves not only expanding that event center for performing arts, but also making certain hockey upgrades to the main arena, which is a multi-purpose arena used by Minnesota State University conventions and also a lot of concerts. In addition to that, we have a community arena that was actually partially funded in addition, I think, 15 years ago with Mighty Ducks dollars, or 10 years ago, I should say. And we propose to expand that facility for use, continued use, by the Minnesota State men's programs for practice and the women's programs for games. That comprises our essentially three sheets of ice, our convention center, our event center, and then certainly the addition will provide us some flexibility to better utilize and maximize that facility. What I'd like to do is turn it over to Rick at this point in time, Rick Strucka, and he can talk a little bit of why this project's important for Minnesota State University. And then we'll go down and talk about some of the features of this project and the economic impact. Rick.
Welcome, Mr. Strucka. Please say your name for the record.
Rick Strucka, Vice President of Finance Administration at Minnesota State University, Mankato. I'd like to first start out by recognizing that this facility finally has produced its first Olympian, David Backus, a Minnesotan who was the first person named to the U.S. Olympic team in the presentation a couple of Saturdays ago. So we're very excited about David as an alumnus of ours. The importance, I'll start with...
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. We're very proud of David. He's a great kid, young man, I should say now, doing very well. I'll first talk about the expansion and improvements at the Downtown Civic Center. It's we're a big part of the downtown community. The Civic Center was originally built as a partnership with with Minnesota State and the city. Is our hockey team at that point faced a decision as Division II was being eliminated to move up to Division I hockey. And the city stepped forward and built this arena for us, and we're very grateful for that. We are the main tenant of the arena, and we take up generally 18 nights a week, 9 weekends generally, where we average about 4,500 attendees to our games. That has a tremendous economic impact to our community. If you come down to downtown Mankato on a game night when our men's program is playing, you will see an incredible hustle and bustle of activity. It is an incredible generator to the hospitality industry and to the vitality of downtown Mankato. The improvements that are here for us as we look at some of the improving rinks around us, the new deck center that's coming forward out of Duluth, the new arena at Bemidji, and some of the improvements there, the improvements that are moving forward for us will help maintain our competitiveness in a program, which I think is important not just for us being competitive, but it's important for the city as well. The more competitive we are, the more fans we have in the game, and the more business that creates for downtown Mankato. It's an important partnership that we have. Secondarily, I'll talk about the Performing Arts Center. It will create a venue with a number of seats that we don't currently have the capability on campus to host certain types of music events and certain types of speakers. By sharing a facility instead of building a brand new facility, we just think it's the smartest thing to do for the taxpayers, that we're being very good stewards of the taxpayer money by continuing what we think is a model partnership of sharing facilities instead of building separate facilities in the same community. And finally, the improvements that are being made to the All-Seasons Arena are incredibly important for us. Our women have chosen to play at a smaller arena. It's an NHL size rink, which is the preferred ice sheet size for women's programs. The rink downtown for our men's program is an Olympic size rink. There are very few women's programs who play on Olympic size rinks. Our women have chosen year after year, we survey them, and they want to stay in that rink. We've recently gone through a review by the Department of Education Office of Civil Rights, where though we were not cited for being out of compliance, they definitely did note that they would like to see us try to increase the amenities at our women's competition facilities to try to mirror some of the amenities that are available at the downtown location and the men's arena. So we believe it's really important for the success of our programs and our commitment to gender equity. I think it's safe to say that we believe we are a model of gender equity in athletics at Minnesota State University Mankato, where in this current time we actually make sure that we have a proportional commitment to student athletes. We have the same number of women and men's student athletes. We also commit more scholarships to women than we do to men. I think we're a model in the NCAA in our commitment to gender equity. This improvement to the All Seasons Arena, we think, would uphold our commitment to that level of gender equity for our athletes.
At the risk of getting myself in trouble, I think the Minnesota State High School League made a mistake moving the girls' tournament from the Ritter Arena to the XL Center. And the only reason I say that is because 1,000 people in the Ritter Arena, it actually looks like it's full, whereas you put 1,000 people in the XL Center, and you can't even tell there's anybody in it. So I realize that sometimes you want to do things exactly the same, but every now and then I don't think it works out for the best for everybody. Senator Saxhawk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The women's arena now would seat how many?
It seats about 1,000 people at this point in time, but basically what we'd intend to do is create chair seating, creating a similar miniature version of our main downtown arena.
And the Performing Arts Center, the improvement of that venue, how many?
That'll seat approximately 1,100.
Okay, who wants to go next?
Perhaps we could have a presentation on that part of our proposal.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Is it your name?
Yep.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Shannon Robinson, and I'm the executive director of the Twin River Center for the Arts in Mankato. And we really serve as a hub for arts and culture in the region, and work with up to about 40 different arts and culture organizations in addition to individual artists. Over the past few years, as Mankato has grown as a regional center for healthcare and education and retail and industry, we've also grown as a regional center for arts and culture. And I think that's shown because the nonprofit arts industry in South Central Minnesota generates up to $9 million a year in economic impact, which is really significant for our region. The addition of an 1,100-seat auditorium has broad-based support from the arts community in Greater Mankato and from the community as a whole. But it's very significant for our arts organizations. It would provide a venue to some of our regionally significant organizations, such as the Mankato Symphony Orchestra, which has been around for over 50 years, and they really do serve the whole of southern Minnesota. It would also serve organizations like the Mankato Ballet and the Mankato Children's Chorus, which, although Mankato was in their names, they sometimes can't find a suitable performance area in our own community and have to go outside of the community to perform, and they serve hundreds of children every year and draw in people from all over southern Minnesota as well. So it's very significant for our regional arts organizations. And in addition to that art significance, the auditorium would have a huge impact on our tourism and convention industry. It would free up the main arena that's at the Civic Center right now for more conventions and other meetings, events, concerts, because right now with all the hockey and all the other events, it's booked a lot and there's a lot of conflict, which actually every year costs Mankato about $3.7 million annually in lost revenue because of those conflicts with other events. So this addition of the auditorium would be really significant for our convention and visitors bureau and for drawing more people into our community and into southern Minnesota. So with that being said, I will turn over to Jonathan Ziert.
Mr. Chairman and committee, my name is Jonathan Ziert, and I serve as the president and CEO for an organization we call Greater Mankato Growth. That's our community's version of the Chamber of Commerce, an economic development organization, and our convention and visitors bureau. And you've heard a lot of conversation today about jobs and economic impact, and I really want to highlight those elements related to this project. You've got a handout in front of you, and if I take you to the back side of that handout, there are some keys there with regards to the economic impact and to the jobs. The first thing I bring to your attention is this project, as it goes forward and it's ready to go, creates 450 construction jobs, direct construction jobs. The result in $84 million in impact from the construction of the project alone. And that's from the construction industry, support industries, et cetera. So not just the $30 million or slightly smaller price tag, but $84 million, 450 jobs. Secondly, there are additional economic activities in our city center, in our downtown. There's currently a project underway that's about $6.5 million that's residential and commercial that's underway. But I can also tell you that there's another commercial project in the works that's about another $7 million of private commercial development that sits ready to go, but is contingent on the foregoing of this project. This project must move forward in order for that private commercial development to take place as well. So really, there sits a good $14 million in additional private commercial development that sits ready to go on the heels of this as well. And then finally, as Shannon alluded to with regards to convention activity and additional activity that can be held in an expanded arena, there's an additional $27.6 million of economic. Mind you, that's direct impact, so that's without any multiplier. That's the dollars that you're the Convention and Visitors Bureau Executive Director of Rochester said when we talked about the $118 per person per day. That's what that figure is relating to, is that direct expenditure without any multiplier. So the figure gets bigger if you start multiplying it one or two times. And then finally, the other piece that I would add is as the state's newest metropolitan statistical area, we are a significant regional center, and as a regional center supporting the geography around the Greater Mankato marketplace, amenities like this and the improvement of amenities like this are really critical to those surrounding communities and to our core community in supporting those communities and those businesses that really rely on having these kinds of regional amenities to not only retain but attract future talent or future workforce. That's really the key to economic development, is that ability to have talent and keep it in the marketplace. Having amenities like this gives you that quality of life everybody strives for to retain and attract that workforce. So that would be the piece you don't see on here with numbers, but it's as important as anything.
You know, one of the things that we've been hearing from, I think for couple of years now, is that as a result of the economy, that the cost of materials for many of these projects is down right now, and that there's no better time than now than to do these projects. Are you experiencing that type of a? I don't know if you even know yet because we haven't.
Well, Mr. Chairman, that was our direct experience. We did have the opportunity to have some of the federal stimulus dollars come to our community. And this, in at least my 27 years of public service, this is probably one of the most competitive bid markets we've ever had. So our projects consistently came in under budget, probably 10 to 15%. I would just add that our project has been shovel-ready for 2 years now. And we expect to fully get off the ground this project as soon as the legislature and the governor, hopefully, would approve it. We would be in the ground with the remodeling because we have to get completed by October for the WCHA season. And then we will be actually building and completing the main arena within from 18 months from the summer, the auditorium addition. That represents about two-thirds of the overall construction. But that will be, we've done all the pre-planning, paid for that through our dollars. We're just be in the stage of putting construction documents together, hopefully a bonding bill and favorable approval from the governor could come out as early as March, in our opinion, would be ideal.
Well, you know what the legislature thinks of your project, so.
And we thank you for your past support.
Okay. Any comments or questions from the committee? Senator Sharon, any closing comments?
I think that you've heard this project before. You've been supportive before. We're hoping that you will be again. There are so many important points that have been made here from my colleagues on this project that I would be fearful to not name some of them, but it has been approved before by the Senate, been vetoed two times. We have demonstrated in the remarks by Jonathan Zert, contrary to what the governor says, these projects do mean real economic development and jobs. We've done studies in Mankato to demonstrate that that's the path. $27.6 million in economic direct impact. Really are proud of the fact of the collaborative that's created in this between the university and the community of Mankato. In the past, although this has not been funded, all the legislature has approved our funding mechanisms, which have called on the local tax base to pay for this project, even though the benefactors of it are regional and also include the university. So it's unique in that, as opposed to other requests that you've had for similar civic centers or hockey arenas to be paid for by the state. This community has not done that in the past. It's one of the reasons why you've agreed to support it in the past, and we hope that you'll continue to do that in the future, since it's the first time that we've asked you to partner with us on the actual construction costs. And we want to be competitive with others in many ways, but if we have to use our resources, more local resources than others, it's difficult for us to create the facilities that allow our hockey team to compete.
Well, maybe,
jobs are important.
And maybe if we did it, we'd get rid of the one goal games that they've been going through this year.
So jobs are a major interest to our community, as they are in all of the communities. There are a significant number of jobs created that not only create the construction jobs, but the products that come in, the businesses in our community that sell those, and the support services that support the construction industry, food, lodging. So as in all other communities, these kinds of investments in our communities will create a stimulus for their economy.
Okay. Thank you all very much. Appreciate you coming up to the Capitol to present this again, and hopefully we can get it done this time. So we'll lay this over for possible inclusion in the recommendation to the bonding committee. Cap?
Mr. Chair, members, we have another round of bonding hearings on Thursday morning at 9 a.m., and then we have a joint hearing with the Jobs and Business Committee in the afternoon on Thursday, and then there are additional bonding hearings, I think our last, on the 26th of next week.
Okay. Any questions or comments from anybody on the committee? All right. Then meeting's adjourned.
Lots of projects.